come to discussion of Troy, we must come to the discussion of the other psychoanalytic of fundamental importance today, and maybe the discussion of Carl Gustav Jung. Now, Jung's break with Freud was, if you like, almost a kind of logical necessity. Jung always felt uncomfortable within that Jewish sect in Vienna. For his background, of course, was totally different. Not that I want to say that background is all that matters, but nevertheless, he was a Protestant clergyman's son, brought up in Switzerland, lived in Zurich, in the kind of security which Freud did not know at all in Vienna. Moreover, all his life, Jung, in one way or another, was religious, brought up in the Zwinglian faith, that is, in the Protestant Reformed faith. But together with this quite different background, which was found to make him uncomfortable in the Freudian sect in Vienna, it is also true that with Jung, things were much more internalized than with Freud. This may be again a result of his relative security in Zurich and Switzerland. But it is true and obvious from his autobiography, which was published only after his death in 1963, that he merely lived in a dream world, and that for him a reality had very little meaning, that really his world was a dream world that somehow connected him to reality, and that during large periods of his life, his hold on existing reality was very slim indeed. So where you must say that as far as Freud is concerned, it's just the other way around, that he was a positivist. For Jung, everything was anti-positivistic. Not only his background, but also, if you like, his inner life, his hold on reality. And indeed, as he says, his hold on reality was only made possible by his rhythm of work, and by his family life, that he had very little relationship to the society or to the culture in which he lived, which is and isn't true, as we shall see in a minute, but again it explains what I'm trying to say. For Jung, of course, does much more than merely broaden the content of the consciousness of some Freud. But you might say quite rightly, he changes its entire direction. And it begins with something as basic as the relationship of consciousness to the unconscious, and something, if you like, as basic as that. For the relationship of the consciousness to the unconscious, he defined, not as Freud defined. Remember, Freud defined it like a rider and a horse, the ego and the id. But Jung said something quite different. In reality, the psyche is the mother, the subject, and the possibility for consciousness. The psyche reaches so far beyond the boundary line of consciousness that the latter could easily be compared to an island in the ocean. In other words, the image is not the rider and the horse, but the island in the ocean. Consciousness is an island in the ocean of the unconscious. The ocean really determined by the id, if you like, we'll see in a minute. And this is a quite different metaphor, with obviously a quite a different kind of results, which we have here. Quite different. You have it again in another way. When Freud writes, the unconscious is not a demonic monster. That's written against Freud, of course. That's written against Freud. The unconscious is not a demonic monster, but a thing of nature that is perfectly neutral as far as moral sense, aesthetic taste, and intellectual judgment go. It is dangerous only when our conscious attitude towards it becomes false. In other words, the basic thing to remember about Jung is that he turns Freud on his head in that sense. What is bad is to extend too far the island of consciousness in the sea of the unconscious. Because the unconscious are not these bad, anti-Semitic, irrational forces attacking liberal Vienna, but rather the unconscious is in fact neutral, is in fact not a bad at all, provided it is not, as we would say, pushed to the wall. For it is from out the unconscious that Freud explains, of course, the human nature, and by human nature he means the archetype, a word obviously that he made famous, and that you will read about in your reading, but let me give you his own definition, because again, everything springs from that. For once you get out of the positivistic world, two things become important to you if you are young out of this atmosphere. History, the past, for which Freud as a positivist never cared. He was like Max Nordau, didn't really care for history. History in Freud is made the present. He analyzes in a way, if you like, through the ego and the id. History is analyzed away. It has no meaning for Freud, but it is of cardinal meaning, obviously, for Jung. And secondly, the irrational, or as Jung will put it, the spiritual forces are important here, while for Freud, of course, they are the enemy. So Jung describes archetypes as follows. And this is the historic description. Archetypes resemble beds of rivers, dried up because the water has deserted them, though it may return at any time. An archetype is something like an old water course along which the water of life flowed for a time, digging a deep channel for itself. The longer it flowed, the deeper the channel, and the more likely that sooner or later the water will return. Archetypes, therefore, are like river banks. They are deep channels. They come, in other words, from the historical past. And no matter what happens, sooner or later, you will return in your unconscious to this historical past. And that historical past will determine the nature of your unconscious. For the unconsciousness is the archetype. And therefore, if you extend too much the island of consciousness, the island of rationality, the stereotype will strike back. And that is, of course, Carl Gustav Jung's famous explanation for National Socialism. That the German archetype is the god Wotan. And what has happened with National Socialism is that as the Jews and the Weimar Republic extended too far the island of consciousness, the god Wotan has struck back. The archetype has struck back, and the German archetype has again flown into the old pagan Wotan, as it were, a riverbank itself. And there you can see it again. So there is here primitivism. There is here primitivism. There is religion. And above all, of course, always religious symbolism. The god Wotan is pagan religion. It is a religious symbolism. So the archetype is expressed by a kind of religious symbolism, yes? And therefore, Jung makes a statement you would never get from Freud, who hated religion, as you may remember. As may be seen, I attribute a positive value to all religions. In their symbolism, I recognize those figures which I have met in the dreams and fantasies of patients. Dream analysis and analysis of the archetype. Dream analysis meant analysis of a suppressed archetype. Going back to the archetype, which has been covered over, suppressed. And therefore, dream analysis uncovers not sexuality, not sexuality, but history and religion ancient religion, like pagan religion, but also Christ, as you will see, original religion, of course, is discovered as well. Now here clearly, we are very far away from what you would call a science. Very far from science. And indeed, not only are we far from science and rationalism, we are in the last resort far from individuality, from individualism, from this heritage of the Enlightenment so strong among the Jewish bourgeoisie of Vienna. For the archetypes are, of course, by their very nature, collective archetypes. The unconscious is by its very nature collective. It can't be individual. If what informs the conscious is the past, for Jung, all past is a collective past. The god Wotan is shared with all other Germans. Christ is shared with all Christians. The spiritual religion are shared with others. So that the unconsciousness, we must be clear, is an unconscious, is a collective unconscious. A collective unconscious is not an individual unconscious. That is all important, and look out for it in your Jung reading. Therefore, what is man's problem? Man's problem is the increase of artificial consciousness and over the collective unconscious. Alienation means that. It's not alienation from your sexual past. It's not alienation because of the Oedipus complex, because of sexual childhood experiences. The alienation from your individuality, from rationality, from culture. It's not the fact that you can't sublimate or repress enough as to produce modern culture. On the contrary, what you are alienated from is the collective unconscious. Your rationality has increased too much against your irrationality. Your individuality has increased too much against your collective unconscious. How does he put it? He says that something belonging to the unconscious powers has been torn out of its natural connections, archetypal connections, and has been subordinated to conscious choice. The man who has usurped the new knowledge suffers a transformation, an enlargement of consciousness, which no longer resembles that of his fellow men. He has suddenly raised himself above the human level. He has become like a god, and therefore he will now suffer the pain of loneliness. There is nothing more anti-Nietzschean than Carl Gustav Jung. Alienation is loneliness. The loneliness in modern man. The loneliness of modern man who has detached himself from his collective unconscious. Or again, the man whom we can with justice call modern is solitary and lonely. He is so of necessity and at all times. For every step toward the fuller consciousness of the present moves him further from his original participation mystique with the mass of men. In other words, he has cut himself off from his archetype. And the archetype is a collective archetype, part of the collective unconscious. Now you can't really go much further afield from Freud than this. For what then is the crime of modernity? It is, as he puts it, the de-spiritualization of the world. And the world has become de-spiritualized, as Carl Gustav Jung puts it. It has lost its spiritual factor. But if the historical process of de-spiritualization of the world is going on as it has, everything must return to the soul. It means that the psychoanalyst's business to strengthen the soul, a word Freud would never use, of course, the collective soul, the collective unconscious, and to put the island back with its boundary, because the island of the consciousness has, as it were, overflowed its lagoons. And that is what is really the matter. Now, quite clearly, the archetype and the symbol are important. It is a world which is very largely a symbolic world. And because it is the unconscious which matters, and therefore it is a world of symbolism that matters. Now, with Freud, symbols were transparent. Remember I told you. Symbols are explained away. Everything seems that way, but it isn't that way. With Jung, it's the other way around. The symbols are the reality, because the symbols come from the archetype. So you can't simply analyze the symbols away by reducing things to irrationality, to science, to sexual childhood experiences, or reducing it to all of this. You can't rationalize it away in that particular way. You have to take symbols seriously, because your symbols are the symbols of your past, the symbols of Wotan, the symbol of Christ, the symbol of the collective unconscious. It is therefore illusion here is reality. It's just the other way, really, from Nietzsche. The totally other way, if I can put it that way, but from Nietzsche, symbol is reality. A symbol, he says, loses its magical, its redeeming power. Now notice, he's like Le Bon. He associates everything with magic, because Le Bon is also the symbol is reality. It's magic. A symbol is the redeeming power. An effective symbol, therefore, must have a nature that is unimpeachable. It must be the best possible expression of the existing world philosophy, of the archetype. Its form must be sufficiently remote from comprehension as to frustrate every effort to grasp it critically. In other words, the whole thing about collective unconscious, the archetype, is of course that you cannot grasp it critically. You have had too much of a critical mind. That is what makes you lonely. And therefore, in order to grasp symbols, symbols must not be critical, and they must be unimpeachable. In other words, the kind of symbols that Le Bon talks about, they didn't know each other, but it's typical that Le Bon and Jung talked about the same thing at the same time. That world is made out of masses and symbols. And alienation is loneliness from masses and from symbols. The symbols of religion, for example, are therefore crucial to Carl Gustav Jung, because the symbols of religion are based on faith, they are historical, they go far back in history, and they are therefore part of your collective unconscious. They are part of the shared collective unconscious. We are back with the myth of Le Bon and Sorel, the explanation of the crowd, the collectivity, all of these things Jung reflects very well. For Freud, symbols were supposed to be done away. For Jung, the id, collective unconscious, is of course very important. You can never, never, never cut off from your archetype. You can never do that. The enemy becomes the idea of ruthlessness. And the enemy becomes those who are too critical, are those who are too ruthless, are those who are too individualistic. Jung's psychoanalysis, therefore, comes down to a study of archetypes, of the primitive. That is why his interest in primitive art, in the primitive religion, but also in original Christianity, in archaeology. We arrive at mass psychology. We arrive at rootedness. And eventually, we arrive at race. For what starts out as being a shared archetype with Jung by the 1930s comes to being a shared race. And that makes a lot of sense. If the archetype is determined by your history and by collective memory, well, that is all racism is. It is collective memory and collective history. So it becomes racist, and it becomes that great understanding of national socialism. That is why Carl Gustav Jung became, for all intents and purposes, a national socialist. For it is also clear, of course, that the collective unconscious makes for the well-adjusted man, the dynamic man, that modern man, and obviously here modernity is condemned, while Frau Freud exalts it, here it's condemned, that must be clear. A modern man, in a way, modern man is uprooted. Modern man is shallow. And that is why he calls, for example, the Jews, whom he blames for modernity, more or less civilized business people. While, of course, Germans and Swiss have, as it were, a collective unconscious. Jews do not have a collective unconscious with him, obviously, because they do not share the memories of either primitive religion or Christianity, either Wotan or Christ. And for Jung, in the end, there was nothing in between of Wotan or Christ. So then obviously, the individualism, the critical mind, this was always blamed on the Jews. They were what he called in 1934 cultural nomads. And of course, if you are a cultural nomad, then you are to blame yourself for National Socialism. For as Jung put National Socialism in this category, he said, Wotan the Wanderer has awakened. Because the Jews have pushed back the island of rationality with their constant criticism and critical mind. Therefore, it is quite logical that the collective unconscious will assert itself, that Wotan will awaken, and that Wotan will strike back. That is quite logical and follows. Not only Wotan, but Christ as an archetypical figure, as well. For the Protestant Jung, that is obviously clear. Now, in all of this, I want to point out to you several things. First of all, it is little wonder that Jung, unlike Freud, understood his age, and indeed joyed in his age. That he was not afraid, of course, of the age of the masses. In a sense, he is the psychoanalyst of the age of the masses, together with Carl Winslow Bohm, of course, together here. And it is not surprising that he understood and accepted the irrationalism of National Socialism and of Marxism. Secondly, Carl Gustav Jung's psychoanalysis fitted in, as Freud did not, with the loneliness of modern man. It addressed itself to a major problem. And Freud addressed himself indirectly. To be sure, Freud wanted to adjust modern man to modern culture, to pain and repression. But Jung does not adjust to pain and repression at all. Carl Gustav Jung adjusts you by turning back your critical faculties and for your collective unconscious. This is not a painful thing like sublimation. This has to do with expressing yourself. That is why you have in Jungian psychoanalysis these free flowing movements, as you may know, and all of this, because you must, first of all, accept yourself and your irrationality. And it isn't a matter of culture being a product of suppression and sublimation. Culture is a product of symbols and the collective unconscious. And therefore, National Socialist culture was a perfectly proper culture. Because Jung was right that it was a culture which everybody liked. And so you can say, in practice, Jung, not Freud, was proven correct between the wars, because it is, of course, National Socialist culture that everybody likes and still does like that sort of thing. So that when you have the idea of symbol and the idea of collective unconscious, it is quite clear. Certainly, of course, you have this idea of rootedness and uprootedness. You have in Jung the great, what we call, neo-romanticism, the new romanticism of primitivism. Really primitive. Jung believed that Protestantism had become too liberal. He was, of course, right. that Protestantism has lost its mysticism, its mystique, and it becomes liberal. So an archetype is really apt to go back to pagan archetype. The riverbed is very deep, and the collective unconscious, which you all share, well, you know, I don't know what it would be in America. Only the Indians have an American collective unconscious, because for all of you, you don't share a collective unconscious. Some of you goes back to the Druids of Scotland, and some of you goes back to I don't know what. You come from everywhere, and you haven't been in America long enough to develop a collective unconscious. So obviously, Jung never knew what to do about America or Australia, for example, which is still younger. And there he came to a few mysticists. He believed, for example, that some spirit comes from the Australian soil and gives you a collective unconscious. Now that's wonderful, because I've been in Australia rather recently, and for Jung, of course, I have no collective unconscious, and that's why I felt so well since I come back, that the Australian soil has given me this mystique, for I obviously lack gift.
What would he say specifically about the positivists? What did he say? Would they be ruthless?
The positivists to him are part of this island. They're always trying to extend the island of the consciousness. They are due to the maladjustment. They are why you need, of course.
Yeah, they weren't just Jews. That was a really big movement.
In Freud's days, it was but he thought in terms of psychoanalysis. So all positivism was bad. Eventually, the Weimar Republic was bad. Yes? He lived all his life near Zurich in Küsnacht. He never left that very much. Yes? He lived all life was bad. But he attacked all positivism. And he exalts, of course, German stereotypes, the stereotype of Faust, the Faustian man. We'll come back to it when we talk about Spengler and the decline of the West later. Yes? All this archetype. No, the original sin is ruthlessness. The original sin is extending things. No. Religion to him was something singularly dynamic. You can say that his attitude towards change is very ambivalent, but it's ambivalent because of the landscape. He was a psychoanalyst. He was enough of a scientist so to have rational explanations for the irrational. You can see he dissolves the archetype, but basically it is like Freud, irrational explanation for the irrational. He thought of himself, I'm glad to mention it, in this term of a scientist, though of course he was less of a scientist than Freud in every way, yes? But it's still basically, of course, proved by cures and not by original sin. And of course, there we are in a realm which is not straight, because I've known as many people or more that have been cured by Freudian psychoanalysis than I have known, as a matter of fact, by Jungian analysis. So that's a matter altogether different. Yeah? Jung thought that it is the cure, yes? But it is always the individualism. It is always the mystique, even in the end on the soil. And there is in Jung a kind of preference to spiritualism, yes? He used to make spiritual experiments, yes? He made experiments of spiritualism for my youth. In fact, I was present in one of them, where he tried to make a medium talk, and all of that sort of thing. And there is no doubt that he was greatly attracted to all of this. But to him, in the last resort, you know... maybe I can summarize it this way. The collective unconscious forces its way into experience and weds itself to the collective conscious. There occurs a creative act which concerns the entire epoch. In other words, you may have collective consciousness, but it must be wedged into collective unconscious. It's not like the right and the horse. There can be no domination. If you want to make it, there has to be a balance. But the balance is very strongly shifted towards the collective unconscious, from the collective consciousness. But no matter how you put it, there is always a collective consciousness. Yes? For Jung grapples with quite a different problem than Freud in one sense. Freud was a Jewish middle-class person. He was in one sense very like the Freud. He believed in culture, order, cleanliness, culture, being civilized to each other, or whatever you call it. But Jung really didn't believe in culture. He was really much more concerned with community, with camaraderie, with community, with society of affinity, really. Much more concerned with this. What is the relation of the individual to the nation, to camaraderie? Freud despised the nation, really. He didn't know what to do with it. But therefore you can say, if you like, and I think this is true historically, that Jung addressed himself to much more relevant problems than Freud, because the problems that Freud addressed himself were already out of date after 1918. In other words, when Freud wrote The Civilization of Discontent and talked about the culture of order and cleanliness, that wasn't where it was at in 1918. Where it was at, where National Socialists and Fascists and Communist mass marches and mass movement and unambiguous symbols and all sorts of archetypes barking at you in one way or another, like Wutan or whatever you have, you know, the Germanic in your soul. So, in a sense, it's true, but we mustn't go too far. For example, let's dwell for a minute about Jung's a definition of personality, because I think that's quite important from this point of view. What is his definition of personality as such? Personality is the highest realization of the inborn distinction, of a distinctiveness, of a particular living being. In other words, distinctiveness. Personality is an act of the greatest courage in the face of life. It means the affirmation of life, the individualist. But that act of individualist must be connected to the collective unconscious. In other words, it's an act like Hitler. It isn't, in a sense, an act like Jenny Triton or Corinna. It's an act like Hitler, an act that must be within the collective unconscious. Or let me put it still better. It is, in fact, the act of Le Bon's leader. The modern leader, who must lead but be a part of the collective unconscious, who must lead but share the myth of everyone else. It's that kind of personality. He wasn't against personality, but the personality had to be a Germanic personality, or an Italian personality, or whatever. A personality that grows out of collective unconsciousness, that hasn't left the critical, that hasn't too much of a critical mind, and that believes in the symbol of the collective unconscious. And what you have here is, as we should come next week, the kind of leadership idea, isn't it, that you have of Carl Gustav Jung. That must be clear. But when you have that, he did believe that you got a kind of psychic distance, a kind of psychic insight. Now what then is creativity, you see? Jung has much more room for creativity than Freud. Freud's link to creativity is, I think, very tenuous, because it depends how much sublimation and depression. But with Jung, it's quite clear he believes in the romantic genius, as Freud doesn't. Creativity is a pushing to the core of your creative unconscious. Creativity is, cannot be a rational thing, as indeed it isn't, of course. And for Jung, certainly creativity is none of that. For the essence of the work of art does not consist in the fact that it is charged with personal peculiarity, but that it rises above the person and speaks out of the heart and mind of humanity. The personal is a limitation, but even a vice of art. That is to say, art and creativity must be linked to the creative, to the collective unconscious, And here, of course, Jung is also a conservative. There can be no avant-garde. The guard is, in fact, Nazi art, or Bolshevist art, or what have you, yes? That speaks to the collectivity, yes? If it doesn't speak to the collectivity, then your island of rationality has grown too far, and then you are, in a way, unbalanced. That must be clear. Jung always longed for the Dionysian man, always longed for something that is not artificial. And perhaps here I should say, with all the other things I've given you, is his objection to artificiality. In a sense, a critical mind to him is an artificial mind. His objection to artificiality. Because you are always, in the last resort, and I can't stress that too much, a part of the historic force. The historic forces we have tricked you. Jung has much more to give to the discipline of history than Freud, of course. It is sufficient to know that there's not a single important idea of you that does not possess historical antecedents. They are all founded upon archetypal primordial forms whose sensuous nature takes from the time when consciousness did not yet think, but merely perceive. So that with Jung, it is always a matter of perception. Thinking is a modern activity, but your archetype goes back into the riverbed of perception, of history and of perception. And perception is a modern German word, which is difficult to translate. The word Schauen, which really doesn't mean perception, but grasping emotionally. Grasping emotionally. You have to grasp emotionally, because thinking is a recent activity. Thinking has its place, there is the island of consciousness. But the problem of modernity is that the island of consciousness has cut loose, and therefore you're lonely. And what you really need is being connected again. Connected with religion, with symbols, with archetypes. And for Jung, when he became, as he did in 1933, the editor of the chief Nazi psychoanalytical journal, National Socialism was at first a cure, the cure for the German psyche, which had gone wrong. And it is therefore that Jung became disillusioned with National Socialism. When he saw the reality of persecution and so on, he jumped off. Eventually, by 38, he left it. But at first, it was a good thing to destroy Jewish psychoanalysis. Because Jewish psychoanalysis destroyed rationalism and positivism. And National Socialism for him was Germany curing itself. The island of rationality had gone out of hand. I think we've got to look at it that way. And that is why he became the editor of the chief Nazi psychoanalytical journal, and that is, I think, why he jumped off that again, eventually, when he really saw the reality. Because, and I must make that clear, there is in Jung an idea of balance, a kind of idea of balance. But it is, as I said, a kind of gendered balance. It is a balance that kills, in a way, I think. Instinct and spirit, then, must be in harmony, but not instinct really in reason. There is a finality when Freud called Jung, and he was quite right, and Freud called Jung the destroyer of reason. And there's a great deal of truth to that. But of course, the destruction of reason was universal. And perhaps you can say that what Freud thought predominant was never really predominant. That Freud confused, as we are apt to, his own cultural position with the cultural position of everyone else, and that he thought that he could strengthen that cultural position with the cultural position of anyone else. Now clearly, Carl Gustav Jung's influence was lost. Because, and I come back to that, he was a good doctor. He cured. And of course, after the war, his theories were somewhat modified, because it became, of course, compulsive for the Jungians to deny and for him to deny that he had once been a Nazi for all intents and purposes. So after the war, there was a general cleaning up of all of this to a certain extent, and that must be clear, and that is clear from the book you read. It's almost impossible to get a Jungian book which gives the kind of analysis I've given, because the Jungians prevent it, and they have the copyright. It's like Nietzsche and his sister, yes? The copyright. So you will not even find a good book or article written about Jungian as a Nazi, because all the documents are carefully locked up of this creature, and of course for obvious reasons. He did not die, after all, till 1963. But until 1963, he really basically did not change his ideas, and until 1963, he did it in. Now, having said all of this, when we look at the whole picture of Freud and Jung, I come back to where I start. That psychoanalysis, whether it tilts one way or another, was trying to make a bridge between life as it is and the kind of revolt against positivism. The New Age, which seemed to Freud too, an age of irrationality, the age of expressionism, of futurism, of all the things you call the attack on manners and morals, of a greater sexual freedom, that seemed an age of irrationality. And yet, there is one thing of that age that we haven't yet left out. For when Freud was frightened by the Neueger movement in Vienna, when Jung looked at the whole picture, what was new was modern mass movement. And modern mass movement were unknown before the end of the century. To be sure, you had riots, but riot isn't a mass movement, as I always told how the student revolutionary. They had riots, but not mass movement. Mass movements must last for at least a month or two. Mass movement, in other words, must have a certain institutionalization to be really frightened. Nobody who knows anything about mass movement was frightened by our student riots. They were just the children's games, because they could never carry through. So mass movements, these people saw, were quite new. The Boulangist movement in France was the first. But the Neueger movement in Germany was the second. Another one, a racist movement in Algeria. There were certain mass movements which were, of course, connected with the growth of urbanism, of industrialism, all these things that I assume you know about. The first mass movement also produced its first analysis. And that is interesting. For the analysis Gustave Le Bon made of the first more modern mass movement, movement connected with General Boulanger, you're reading your introduction, that analysis was going to last. It was going to last. And it was a successful one. For not only did Freud copy from Le Bon, when Freud came to write about mass movement in 1920, he copied from Le Bon. But more important than Sigmund Freud, two other leaders copied from Le Bon. Whenever Hitler in Mein Kampf, written in 1924, talks about how to make effective politics, it is directly copied from the book. And whenever Mussolini in 1912-13 thinks how to make effective politics, it is directly copied from Gustav Le Bon. So then you have a remarkable constellation, which is difficult to explain because it happens very rarely in history. Usually people are people for one season, then are much changed. Take Karl Marx. 50 years after his death, he is no longer recognized. Hegel. They're usually people for one season, and not for a great deal more. But Le Bon remains a man for all seasons, certainly until 1939. Virtually unchanged. And the Second thing remarkable is that the people who acted on him, Hitler and Mussolini, who put them into practice, were the most successful statesmen of the 1920s, 1930s. So that was number four, and certainly hit on something which worked. Now, that is remarkable, because his analysis was made on that movement led by General Boulanger in France, which tried to overthrow the Third Republic, and which was the first mass movement. Why? Because it contained everyone, from socialist to right wing. It was what Gustave Le Bon would call, in his most innovative passage, cross-class crowd. The first major cross-class crowd, where the Boulanger crowd, which lasted after all for 3 or 4 weeks, and which stretched from socialists all the way to the right wing, united behind General Boulanger to overthrow the Third Republic. But you might say this analysis lasted, because it was an analysis very like the one that we have seen. It was an analysis which tried to fuse the rising tide of irrationalism with psychology. Le Bon was a psychologist by trade, a psychoanalyst by trade, which tried to fuse it with a kind of psychoanalysis. Now you might say, why are these so much more successful analysis of modern society than Marxist analysis? I mean, now successful in fact, I don't care, in principle. In principle, everything is fine. But why were these so much more successful analysis in fact? I think there's a reason for that. And the reason is that they fitted in with what was happening. On the one hand, they could encompass as Marxism could not. If you read your Kautsky, it's quite clear, the irrational side. And with the new politics of mass movement, with the loneliness of men, with the nationalist revival, the irrational side has become stronger. Look at the expressionists, look at Wedekind, look at your reading. The irrational side was getting ever much stronger. And yet, because they were still, in a sense, rational, these people were still doctors, medical people, Le Bon also, by the way, medical people, and therefore still had pretensions to a kind of positivism. They were able to make a combination between reality and irrationalism that somehow hit the spot. There were those who were just irrationalists, like the young expressionists, like Wedekind, Moritz and Melchior, if you like Gide, trying to find his nature. All right. These people, and Gide, one would say, or Nietzsche, had a collective unconscious which was functioning. Nietzsche's not very well, because he was detached from all history in the speech, but anyhow, here was irrationality. But the clue to the success of Freud, especially Jung and Le Bon, is that they did try to capture the irrational rationally. And that is the clue to all modern politics. Because if you didn't capture the irrational rationally, you could never make a movement. And because the young people in the 60s here in the riots never tried to do that, they were, of course, totally harmless. Because they never tried to do what you have to do, to capture the irrational rationally. That's, of course, on a lower level, much lower level, what we try to do in this course all the time, or what you must do. Because if you don't capture the irrational rationally, you cannot understand it. And that may have puzzled you about Jung. He's a doctor. He captures the irrational rationally. And unless you understand it, you cannot manipulate it. So in other words, for modern politics, it is of prime importance to capture the irrational rationally. Because unless you do it, you can't manipulate them. And if you can't manipulate them, you are done for. So obviously, you must have this function. And obviously, the importance of Freud and Jung and Gustave Le Bon is that they had this function. And with this, we must come to Gustave Le Bon on Monday. But I'm glad to pause at the beginning on Monday and see what questions you have on human thought. You see, I joined this because they're not taught anymore in America. Jung and Freud, as American positive culture.